I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Businesses in the U.S. make about $25 billion a year on diamond sales. It's the most popular choice by far for an engagement ring. In the mid-20th century, the South African-based diamond company De Beers hired a Philadelphia advertising firm to promote the diamond. They mounted an incredibly successful campaign. Our guest Tom Zellner decided to find out more about the modern-day diamond industry. That quest took him all over the world, to African countries where diamonds are often used to subsidize war and violence, to factories in India where children are paid pennies a day to polish diamonds, to Siberia where chemists are working on a new process for making diamonds, to the Arctic Circle where geologists are drilling for diamonds, to Japan where diamonds are as prized as they are in the U.S., if not more. Tom Zellner's book is called The Heartless Stone, A Journey Through the World of Diamonds, Deceit, and Desire. He's worked as a reporter for Men's Health Magazine and the San Francisco Chronicle, and he joins us this morning on Radio Times. Tom, nice to have you with us. Good morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. I'd actually like to begin our interview with this Philadelphia advertising firm hired by De Beers, the advertising firm in Philadelphia called N.W. Ayers and Son. Why did they pick this firm?
Well, they really had a reputation, this firm did, of being an incredibly blue-chip advertising agency. They represented some of America's top corporations, and they were viewed as the pinnacle of heartland values and really the best ones to tell the diamond story to the rest of the United States.
And they told an interesting story and then told it in an unusual kind of way. Help us understand what their early on campaign was about a diamond.
Well, prior to this point, prior to 1938, which was the year that De Beers had engaged this agency to spread the message, diamonds were not regarded as the cultural imperative for a marriage. They had been seen as certainly tokens of luxury, but they were seen only as the accoutrements of the very rich, John Jacob Astor, gangsters. They were seen as almost tacky. There was not a democratic idea of the diamond in the United States until this time, when N.W. Ayer of Philadelphia did such a brilliant job of convincing the country that the diamond was the signal mark of commitment and love.
And brilliant how? What was their message to the American people?
Well, I went through dozens and dozens of these ads, which ran in very top-flight American magazines, and many of them are very bizarre. They work almost counterintuitively. They spread somewhat of a dismal message in many ways. They told consumers that, they reminded the consumers of their own death, essentially, and said, you are eventually going to pass away, and you are going to want a piece of eternity.
Diamond meaning eternity.
Yeah, thus becomes a surrogate for eternity. Your marriage is going to get very dull and boring, and you're going to want to recapture the early fire when the flames burned high, and a diamond is the best way to capture that. And these ads, they were almost like notes struggling towards a theme, and this theme finally emerged in 1948 when a copywriter, an unmarried copywriter as it happened, named Francis Garrity, at 3 a.m. was struggling to meet a deadline and penned a line and sent it in the next morning, and it was then taken to South Africa in De Beers, and they loved it. They thought this was the best thing they had ever seen, and Advertising Age magazine went on to call this the most successful line ever written in American advertising, and it's only four words, and it captures everything, and everyone, all the listeners of this program, no doubt know it, which is a diamond is forever.
And I guess forever, sort of underscoring this death theme, but without all the sort of dark imagery.
right, exactly. Exactly. I mean, this idea that, there's something in the human heart that quests for that piece of eternity, and, whether it's expressed in religion or mythology, or what have you, that the diamond fills that need in some way.
And this was a campaign aimed largely at men.
Largely at men.
Which is interesting.
Oddly enough, yeah. men were really the target of these ads, and you know, this is a product that had been intended to, you know, to grace the fingers or the necks of women. But no, the ads were aimed at guys, and they did so in a way that was very, very perceptive of the male psyche.
In what way?
Well, you know, men are not generally known for their their ability to put their deepest feelings into words, and so. You know, the diamond became a very convenient package for men to get their messy feelings in order and basically express them with, you know, a big splurge of money and a handing over of a tangible object. And this was a way that men could marshal their feelings into some kind of order.
And the message being a diamond is forever.
The message being, yes, that I love you so much that I'm going to, you know, gift you with this package.
And just to add to this advertising campaign, they also use Picasso and Dolly?
Yeah, they hired you know, very well-known artists to illustrate these ads, which you know, there's a very bleak theme running through these ads. You know, Salvador Dali had these landscapes, you know, that looked like, you know, barren deserts, and they were accompanied by very pompous, highfalutin copy, which you know, reminded you know, the viewer that or the viewer of the ad that, you know, that they were soon to die. And that the diamond really is the only way that their passing on Earth would be noted or remembered.
Well, as strange as this advertising campaign might sound, it worked.
It worked brilliantly. This really shifted the American consciousness into this idea that you had to have a diamond.
And just to add to that also, they worked with Hollywood film companies and celebrities just to begin to work this diamond story into the movies.
Yeah. I mean, at this time, De Beers couldn't do business in the United States because they were adjudged by the Justice Department to be a monopoly and could not have an office here. I mean, they got around that by selling their diamonds to elite wholesalers in London, and then the diamonds were taken over here independently, and there was nothing that the Justice Department could do about that.
And this would be under FDR, right?
This was under FDR, who was infuriated at De Beers for not selling the United States industrial diamonds during the war. He felt that they were undercutting America's war effort. So there's a big war between FDR's Justice Department and De Beers.
But you've got these movies, and you've got another way of getting this message out.
Absolutely. De Beers recognized Hollywood as being a very powerful engine in the American myth-making consciousness. And they had a practice of gifting movie studios, loaning movie studios these you know, incredible, you know, diamond pieces of jewelry, you know, on the condition that they be used in some kind of film. And that, you know, De Beers didn't even mind if the diamonds were used as a plot point that involved crime or intrigue.
I mean, they just wanted the
they wanted that bling on film.
Tell us a little bit about De Beers, and this was a company founded by Cecil Rhodes, of the famous Rhodes Scholar.
Of the Rhodes Scholarship, but you know, his true monument really is not the Rhodes Scholarship or even the nation of Rhodesia. He's one of the only men in history to ever have his name stamped on a sovereign country. His true monument is the diamonds that are sold at outrageous prices underneath you know, glass countertops in every jewelry store in America. He, more than anybody, is responsible for this idea of artificial scarcity that keeps the diamond valuable.
And the artificial scarcity, meaning that this is so valuable because it's so rare, and that's why we can charge so much.
Exactly. And this is somewhat of a false idea, actually. The diamond is not as rare as the price would reflect. I mean, this is a mineral almost like no other in that there is no free market in it. It is not subject to the, you know, vicissitudes of the marketplace the same way that copper or wheat or pork bellies are.
Is that because De Beers is essentially in control of this market?
They are not as much as they used to be. You know, they called themselves the custodian of the trade, and this lasted for, you know, nearly 110 years. They have rethought their business strategy of late, and they now control slightly over half of the rough stones that are produced in the world.
But as you said, FDR had a real beef with De Beers because of antitrust issues. As it stands today, I mean, if the marketplace would be allowed to control the cost of a diamond, do you know what that would be?
There's no way to tell. Certainly the price would plummet. It still is a rigidly controlled market. Mm-hmm. You know, as I say, De Beers has rethought its strategy. It in 2004 settled the last of a series of antitrust cases, and they're now free to do business here, which was something that had never been done before.
You've been to some of the diamond mines in South Africa?
And other places. I've been to the holes that are left from the diamond mines during the historic rush in South Africa.
In fact, you went to the South African Republic, where diamonds have been used to pay for warfare there and conflict and violence.
Yeah, the Central African Republic, which is a nation north of the Congo, is a smuggler's platform. It's used to ferry stones out of conflict areas and move them into the legitimate market.
And how does that work? And you described, I think, something like 80,000 miners working in the Central African Republic in the diamond mines.
Yeah, there are basically parallel industries going on in Africa. There's the legitimate marketplace, and then there's the illicit marketplace. And it's in the illicit marketplace that you see diamonds being used to buy rifles and landmines and so forth, both on the part of rebel groups and governments to keep these civil conflicts alive. And this is the origin of the phrase blood diamond.
Right, right. Or conflict diamond, I'm assuming.
Or conflict diamond. Yeah, they're synonymous.
And how does this smuggling operation work? I mean, how would someone who, let's say, is mining for diamonds, sell that on the black market?
Well, it should be said, in fairness, that De Beers, doesn't like conflict diamonds any more than you or I do. They have taken steps to try and get rid of this. But essentially what happens is diamond mines in African nations become military targets. This becomes a great place to attack if you're a rebel army, because then you can continue to capitalize your war effort. And so the problem then becomes, how do you get those gems onto the legitimate market? Mm-hmm. Now, what De Beers and the rest of the industry did, under great pressure, it must be said, from the United Nations and humanitarian groups, is in 2001 they created something called the Kimberley Process, which is a scheme to make sure that these conflict diamonds don't enter the marketplace. The problem is it's full of loopholes. It's very easy to get around, and there's the two biggest problems with them that I've identified in the book are that African borders are very porous. It's very easy to smuggle goods to and fro without paying any tribute at all to the border, and so you can easily move a diamond from a conflict zone into a clean nation, give it phony paperwork, and send it on its way. The other problem is that the Kimberley Process only recognizes nations in a technical state of civil war, as defined by the UN.
Meaning declared civil war?
Declared civil war. And so, any student of African politics knows that there are low-grade conflicts going on in nations which are technically in a state of peace. But really, these are diamonds which come from very miserable, bloody circumstances. And, the industry still considers them clean, which, I suppose this is a semantic issue. What do you consider a blood diamond? Mm-hmm. This is a case of definitions. But, to my mind, these are very bloody diamonds.
And we're almost up on a break here. But do these diamond miners, do they know the value of what they are mining?
Often not. And I met guys who were getting severely ripped off.
Getting ripped off by just all the people along
along the pipeline, as it's called, that take their cut. The diamond passes through an average of 6 to 8 hands before it enters the U.S. market.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our guest, Tom Zollner, and we're talking about his new book. It's called The Heartless Stone, and it's subtitled A Journey Through the World of Diamonds, Deceit, and Desire. And it's a book that took him all over the world to Africa, to Brazil, to Siberia, to India, the Arctic Circle, Japan, and joins us this morning on Radio Times. Lines open for any questions or comments about the diamond. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Philadelphia moves forward to the next mayoral election. How will surrounding areas be affected? What issues concern the entire region? How will the future of Philadelphia help determine the future of the entire Delaware Valley? The Next Mayor, a groundbreaking multimedia project to explore the issues leading to the Philadelphia mayoral election. Your issues, your voice. Presented by WHYY, the Daily News, and the Committee of 70. To learn more, visit thenextmayor.com.
I'm Mike McGrath. On the next You Bet Your Garden, I'll help you figure out if your creepy crawly new friends are millipedes or centipedes and what to do about them. plus how tomato plants defend themselves against pests, and chemical-free answers to an especially large selection of your garden questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Some lingering social issues thundered back into America's minds with Hurricane Katrina. But will they just drift away?
Despite some well-intentioned promises that we would engage in this difficult national discourse on race and class, it has not, for the most part, materialized.
I'm Ed Gordon. How to keep the conversation alive after the storm, next time on News and Notes from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about the diamond today on Radio Times. Tom Zollner is our guest. He's written a book called The Heartless Stone and joins us this morning to talk about the adventures he had and what he learned as he traveled the world, trying to figure out why this hardened piece of carbon is so expensive and so highly valued. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We were talking about what you observed at the Central African Republic as you were doing research on this book and the kinds of miners that you met there. And I wonder if you could just flesh out for us some more about who these people are. I know children are often involved in mining for diamonds as well.
Yeah, this is a nation where the poverty rate is so great that diamonds are really your only ticket to any kind of money that means anything. And so what's happened of late is that the diamonds have acquired a certain mythology over there as being the, you know, the representations of the souls of their ancestors, that they're going to bring them riches. And in many ways, it's a mythology not greatly different from the mythology that we have of them over here. You know, this something about this stone really inspires, you know, tremendous narrative behind it. And it might even be said that, you know, the narrative is really the only thing that keeps it alive. Mm. Without it, the diamond is dead.
But can people in this country make a living, even a subsistence living, if they are mining for diamonds?
Some get lucky. Most do not. You know, they children do work in these mines. And, you know, I should clarify when I say mine, you know, we're talking about what's called alluvial mining. And what you're doing is you're panning the sands, you know, much like the prospectors used to pan for gold in California. You're basically sifting the river sands, looking for those diamonds which have washed out of the core of ancient volcanoes. Mm. You know, this is a very low-tech way to mine. And it's very easily done. It just takes a sift, a shovel, and a whole lot of determination. You know, it's unfortunately a business that can be ridden with violence. You know, as I've said, these diamond mines can become military targets. People will kill for these stones. Mm. And the price that they command, particularly in the African backcountry, is not all that great, really. I mean, I met guys who were getting paid, you know, $200 for a quality of a stone that would easily retail once it was, you know, polished and finished and, you know, sent on its way to, for example, a mall in suburban Philadelphia. That stone would command $40,000.
From $200 to $40,000?
From $200 to $40,000.
You include in your book, I guess it's a song that some of these people sing, and the words go, "My money was gone, my friends were gone, I had to go to work at the construction buildings, my life is hard now."
Yeah, the song you quoted is called Kamanga, and it was done by a guy named Ray Weba in the nation of Angola. And he summed it all up for many, many diamond miners in that country, and that's what it's all about. It's kind of a casino economy in some ways. You find a diamond, you get briefly rich, you proceed to waste all the money, and then once again you're back where you started from.
You also went to Brazil, and I wonder how those miners and even those mines compare to the ones that you saw in Africa.
It's very similar, you know, and certainly also the quality of, you know, either you're flush with cash in rare circumstances because you do find a diamond, or mostly you're living in very grinding poverty. And they have a saying in Portuguese, which, you know, cleaned up for the radio would sound like, you know, either you're wearing velvet underwear or your rear end is hanging out.
Oh, really? Yeah. I mean, it's either poverty or temporary riches.
Exactly.
Now, you were accused of being a smuggler, or somehow got not exactly caught up in a smuggling operation, but had a chance to observe it.
Yeah, I was privileged to be able to talk to a couple of diamond smugglers, and they had recently brought over some stones from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is a perennially unstable nation at the heart of Africa, and they were moving these stones over to the Central African Republic.
And how do they some people ingest it? Is that one of the ways that they?
One of the ways you get a diamond out of a conflict zone is to swallow it. Yeah, absolutely, or to conceal it on your person in some manner. And that's part of the reason why diamonds are so insidious over there, is because there's simply no better way to pour a large amount of money into a small package. Mm. And they become very easy to conceal, very easy tools for laundering money.
And I mean, did you have a close call related to this, or did you feel in any way unsafe if you're talking about diamonds, but you're also investigating people who are, sending weapons across borders?
Right, doing something wrong, yeah. Right. Yeah, no, there was one point in which I was detained briefly by the police. I don't think they knew what to make of me, actually, but that didn't last for very long. That was only a couple hours.
How do you, though, I mean, if you're in a foreign country and you're doing research, and how do you hook up with a smuggler? Is it just sort of circumstance being there, reading the situation?
Yeah, you know, that's one thing I learned as a newspaper reporter. You know, I got my start on a paper out in the middle of Nebraska, actually, a biweekly paper where, you know, farm reports and city council meetings were the major grist for news. And it was there that I learned that if you just hang around and are polite and ask the right questions or keep asking questions, it's amazing what people will eventually tell you.
Tell us a little about what you learned in India, and there are factories there that are young people, children in many cases, who are polishing diamonds. That's what they do.
Yeah. India is now responsible for polishing 92% of the world's diamonds. And what this means is you take a rough stone, you know, from the earth, they look very unremarkable. They look like a piece of quartz. You know, I certainly didn't see anything pretty or beautiful about them in any way. And what you do is you map out that stone. You decide how you're going to carve it in a geometrically, you know, pleasing fashion. And then you put it to the wheel. You put facets on it, and you grind it against this spinning metal wheel that's coated with diamond dust. And it's semi-skilled labor. It's not hard to pick up. 1 million people are now doing this in India. Diamonds are now India's fifth largest export product, and it's a big part of the industrial revolution that India is going through right now. The world has outsourced this business to India. And one unfortunate feature of this is that a percentage of this business, it's hard to say how much, just because the business is utterly unregulated. The controls on it are extremely lax. But some percentage of this is being done by children, and estimates have ranged up to 10%. I certainly found abundant evidence that it was going on.
And because you were there, you observed children doing this kind of
work? I never actually saw a kid at the wheel. I met many people who had gotten their start when they were 12 and 13 years old, and the head of the labor department in the Indian state of Gujarat, you know, as much admitted to me that, yeah, this is a rampant problem, and we're powerless to do anything about it.
And how much could someone make polishing diamonds in India?
Well, you know, you have to adjust the economy for, you know, obviously money goes a lot farther there.
Sure.
You know, you're essentially getting paid a dime per diamond that you polish.
And I'm assuming that would require a lot of intensive
concentration
and close-up work as well.
Very close-up work, and this is part of the reason why children are valued, is because of their small hands and their, you know, what's perceived to be their very sharp eyes, that they can do this more effectively.
I know this whole book began because of an engagement that fell apart, an engagement ring that you began to think about. Would you ever buy a diamond, having done this book?
I would not. But nor would I, you know, look down on anyone who did. You know, like, the last thing I want to do is make anyone feel bad because they happen to like diamonds. I mean, I certainly do understand their appeal. I had an enormously hard time getting rid of, you know, my engagement ring.
But you did. You finally sold your engagement ring?
I finally did, and actually in Philadelphia, as a matter of fact.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
And what percentage of what you paid for this ring did you get back?
Well, excellent question. You know, anyone who buys a diamond thinking that it's going to ascend in value is in for a nasty surprise.
Really?
You know, they do not hold their value at all. It's sort of like the analogy of a car being driven off a new car lot, and then, you know, it immediately, you know, you subtract 25% from its value. Yeah, I took a loss. I took a 20% loss.
Is that because diamonds are so personal, as we were talking about in the beginning, that when someone goes out to purchase a diamond ring, it's for a very specific person, a very specific occasion?
Yeah, you know, this is something that De Beers has really understood very well over the years, that you know, there's an enormous amount of feeling invested in that object. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you know, they've never wanted to see a robust secondary market in diamonds. That's the last thing they want to see, actually, because it threatens, you know, the all-important artificial mm-hmm. scarcity.
And even old diamonds, if you take them in, I know you're not, you know, a diamond appraiser, but even those don't necessarily appreciate in value.
They do not.
They do not. Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to start taking some phone calls here on Radio Times. Our guest is Tom Zollner, and he's written a book called The Heartless Stone, A Journey Through the World of Diamonds, Deceit, and Desire. And like many men, he bought a diamond ring and gave it to the woman he had hoped to marry. Well, that engagement was called off, and he got the ring back. And contemplating this engagement ring was the impetus for writing this book. And the book took him around the world, to Africa, to Brazil, India, Siberia, the Canadian Northwest Territories, Japan, and more. Lines open. Any questions or comments? 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Bill from the Northeast to join us. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on
Hi,
Radio
you?
Times. Yep, you're on the air.
I really appreciate, you know, I haven't read your book yet. I definitely plan on getting it. I really appreciate what you're saying about it, because it's one of the things that I had a long time belief in, and understood that it's just like a car. As soon as you take it off of the lot, it starts to devaluate, and how it had a false sense of value.
Sure.
And it's just amazing how the people were able to put out this myth and have people believe that it was actually that value. One of the things I wanted to ask you is, since the so-called change of, you know, apartheid in South Africa, has anything changed as far as the ownership in these diamond mines and been put into the hands of African people?
And this would be about the De Beers company. You want to speak to that, Tom?
Yeah, great question, Bill. No, actually. The short answer is no. You know, the controlling interest in De Beers has been held by the Oppenheimer family since the 1920s, and it must be said that they had positioned themselves as liberals on apartheid, huh. Even though you know, there's a very strong case to be made that, you know, the insidious system of laws known as apartheid devolved from South Africa's wealth in diamonds and gold. They became originally ways to control the labor force, and they took on a, you know, obviously a shape that created misery for millions throughout the years.
And how about today? What's their view of South Africa and its politics and its leadership?
I'm not so up on you know, where De Beers is on, you know, the current state of affairs in South mm-hmm. Africa. But for many years, they had a very, very enlightened self-interest view of apartheid. They viewed it as a system which could not keep itself perpetuating over time.
Bill, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me get Anita from Wilmington to join us. Hi, Anita. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I've always heard that Pat Robertson, the minister, mm-hmm. owns a diamond mine in what was then Zaire. Is that an urban myth or is that true?
Hey, did you find that in any of your research, Tom?
Yeah, I would think that unlikely, although, you know, I'm not discounting it. I have not heard that specifically.
But you have, Thanks. Anita?
Yes, I've heard it for years that he has a diamond mine. And I just don't know if it's, you know, how these stories go around. I thought maybe he'd know.
Well,
thanks anyway.
Sorry about that. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Thanks a uh-huh. lot. Let me throw something else out in, because, again, this is part of your travels to figure out about diamonds. You went to Siberia, where there's some chemists working on actually creating diamonds.
Yeah, this is an incredibly exciting technology and incredibly frightening for the diamond industry. What the Russian scientists did under the cover of the secrecy of the Cold War is they improved on a process that had first been invented in 1954, which was essentially a kind of alchemy. What they did was they invented machines that could recreate the tremendous heat and pressure inside the Earth's mantle and take a scoop of graphite, carbon, and, you know, heat it and squeeze it enough so that it became a chemically perfect diamond. And the Russians improved on this technology. They eventually created machines big enough or powerful enough to grow diamonds the size of garbanzo beans in this warehouse out in Siberia. And I went out there to visit it, and, you know, they assured me, you know, that they had no interest in becoming gemlords. You know, they didn't want to threaten De Beers. They were only doing scientific research. But what happened after the breakup of the Soviet Union is this technology was stolen and bartered and sold off to several interests outside of Russia. And one company that got its hands on it through a contact in the post-Soviet government was an outfit in Florida called Gemesis, and now they're now turning out 500 carats of synthetic, or as they prefer the term, cultured diamonds.
That's what they call a cultured diamond.
Yeah, they prefer the term cultured, although the industry hates that term because it implies something more, poetic than they want to regard it as. And in fact, the battle, this is the really interesting thing about this whole thing, is that the battle over, this whole synthetic diamond creation is all about the poetry behind these stones. De Beers is saying, well, you can't really recreate this wonderful hammer stroke of nature, thing that's been created inside the earth, the forge of God, etc., in a machine, But it gets to the heart of what a diamond is all about, which is all about whatever meaning we choose to assign to it. It's all about the poetry that you write around it.
But it's interesting because you're saying chemically, if you were to sort of look at this chemically, it has the same properties as a diamond that worked its way up from the center of the earth?
It is a diamond.
It is a diamond.
Atom for atom, it is a diamond.
Interesting. Well, I would think even if there's a advertising war over this, that this could change the whole diamond industry, couldn't it?
This has a potential to be an earthquake in the diamond industry, simply because it threatens two things, which are the two things which undergird the entire industry. Number one, artificial scarcity. Number two, the whole notion of the mythology that undergirds the stone. If you strip away that mythology, or if you change the mythology, then you have an industry in chaos.
I'm curious because this mythology seems to have real resonance in Japan, a place you also went. And people might be diamond crazy in this country, but the Japanese seem to have taken it to a higher and even more vociferous level.
Yeah, this is one of the greatest marketing stories of all time. What happened is, Japan never had any role for the diamonds in its courtship ritual. This was alien. You couldn't even import diamonds into Japan until 1954. And during the 60s, De Beers looked at Japan and they saw a huge potential market, the same way that they looked in America in the 1930s and saw a huge potential market for this product. And so they took the same strategy. They hired a very competent ad agency, in this case, J. Walter Thompson.
Well-known name.
Very, very well-known. To basically barrage the Japanese with these very, very clever, well-thought-out advertisements, which, boosted the diamond to a place of near mythology in Japan, as being the thing that was going to be cool and Western and not of the kind of Japan that Japan was trying to get away from, which was, the very, hidebound and dark Japan that led them into World War II. And so this campaign took off beyond anyone's expectations. In 1966, the year that the ads launched, 1% of Japanese women went to the altar with a diamond. Within 30 years, that number had gone to 90%.
90%.
Yeah, and what De Beers did was they remade the courtship ritual in Japan. They essentially recrafted the marriage ceremony, the Shinto marriage ceremony, to accommodate the diamond.
Yeah. And so that I'm not aware of that ceremony, but so that what got exchanged was a diamond ring.
Was a diamond. It became incorporated into this ancient ceremony. And the idea of a romantic proposal, this really was not something the Japanese did prior to the introduction of the diamond. And so what you see here is perhaps advertising's greatest goal, which is to inflame a hunger that did not exist prior.
And that's Tom Zollner, our guest today on Radio Times. Another short break, then we'll get back to our conversation and also back to our callers. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Heartless Stone, A Journey Through the World of Diamonds, Deceit, and Desire. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, our country music series continues with Billy Joe Shaver and Jimmy Dale Gilmore. Join us.
Standing on the corner, I didn't mean no harm.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
By the arm. It was down in Memphis, the corner of Beale and Main.
Next time on Day to Day, after Hurricane Katrina, Stephen and Pam DeFerrari were anxious to return to New Orleans and rebuild their lives.
1 year later, they wish they could leave.
We are thinking of renting our house out and getting away for a year. Just not having to look at it every day for a year would be nice.
Living in a city full of painful memories and few prospects. Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The linguist behind the online language log sheds light on the subtle aspects of grammar. Also, online citizen filmmakers document life after Katrina, New Orleans. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, our guest is Tom Zollner, and we're talking about his new book called The Heartless Stone, A Journey Through the World of Diamonds, Deceit, and Desire. And he did journey around the world to learn about the diamond, and that trip took him to some African countries where diamonds are often used to subsidize war and violence, to factories in India where people are paid pennies a day to polish diamonds, including young children, to Siberia where chemists are working on a new process for making diamonds. He also went to the Arctic Circle where geologists are drilling for diamonds. And we were just talking about Japan where diamonds are as prized as they are in the U.S., if not more. Tom Zollner has worked as a reporter for Men's Health Magazine and for the San Francisco Chronicle. Let's get back to our callers. We've got Mark who joins us from, looks like Bethlehem. Mark, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello.
Hi there.
Great program. Very interesting.
Thank you.
I'm a jeweler, so I thought I would add my two cents.
Go ahead.
There. There's one thing that he was very accurate about, and one thing that he was a little bit inaccurate about. Your guest. As far as the simulant diamonds being created, absolutely right. It's making the Gemological Institute of America have fits about what happens. Is constantly they're trying to be able to come up with ways of identifying what's a simulant and what's real.
Right.
And that does cause a lot of consternation in the industry. And every year it seems to get a little more complicated. You know. Simulants of all kinds, but particularly diamonds.
Sure, and just because of their shared chemical properties and all that, it is hard to figure out what's you said simulant, and what's a so-called real diamond?
Or what's a genuine occurring diamond. I mean, there are certain things which are beyond the scope of this conversation to determine it, but it's becoming increasingly more difficult to look inside of a stone and determine whether it's been created or whether it's been mined.
And Mark is right, and one of the great scams of late is to try and take one of those synthetic diamonds and pass it off as a natural. And if you can get a certificate on that, you've just boosted that diamond's value times four. So,
these
diamonds are popping up with increasing regularity at the gem labs.
And your other point, Mark?
Yeah, the other point was I think he missed a little bit on the idea of a diamond losing value as soon as you purchase it. I think it's the whole kind of retail wholesale thing whereby, if you purchase a stone, obviously there's a markup on it. And, if I purchase one on the wholesale level, that same stone's going to cost me significantly less. So when you turn around and try to sell it, nobody's going to give you the retail. They're going to give you what they would have to buy it for or less. So that may be some of the differential there. Because I can tell you from, you've heard diamonds are forever. Well, there's some truth to that, where that if you took a modern cut diamond, and somebody wore it for a few years, and then you steamed it off and cleaned it. I defy you to tell me if that was just mine or whether it was, previously worn for years.
Sure. Well, Mark, let me get Tom to respond to
your
second point.
Yeah, you raise a good point. I mean, there's a term in the jewelry industry. Mark, you know the term keystone price?
Yeah.
That, as I understand it, is you basically buy a diamond for a dollar and sell it for two. And so, you're absolutely right that, you're never going to get the retail value of that stone as a consumer.
Mark, thanks for the call.
Yeah, fascinating. Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. Let me get Betty from Queen Village to join us this morning on Radio Times. Hi, Betty. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment that my daughter was married last year, and although her fiancé was willing to buy her a diamond, she would not accept one.
Now, why was that, Betty?
She said it was a slave stone, and she was very much aware of how most diamonds are mined.
Mm.
And so they decided to have plain silver bands, and it's a political statement. And I understand that I've heard of some other girls who do not want diamonds for this reason.
Well, that's interesting, and I wonder, because there have been a lot of stories. Your book is just one of many about diamonds, about conflict diamonds, mm-hmm. blood diamonds. You want to speak to that, Tom? Whether you feel like in this country there's a shifting attitude towards diamonds?
Well, there is a growing awareness that there's a big difference in between, you know, what diamonds claim to be and what they actually are. There was a survey not long ago that purported that 30% of American diamond consumers were in some part aware of a blood diamond problem in Africa. And I have heard anecdotally, you know, many, many American women saying, you know, I don't want to be a part of this anymore.
Do you see it, though, as a slave stone, as Betty said her daughter did?
I would reject that that verbiage. You know, certainly diamonds are mined in very unpleasant, you know, often brutal circumstances, but I think slavery stretches it a bit.
The idea that someone owns somebody else and they're forever kind of in there, under their control.
I didn't find evidence to support that that terminology.
All right, Betty, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's go out to Bristol, and we have Heather waiting to join us. Heather, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. This is sort of a counterpoint to what Betty had just said. I'm noticing in advertising and on a lot of women's lifestyle shows that they're pushing for women to buy their own diamonds, that it's no longer a matter of an engagement ring or waiting for someone to give you a ring. I was wondering, do you think that could be a result of the diamond market's fear of these synthetic diamonds getting better and better, or do you think it's just an American cultural, just completely separate from advertising or the diamond market?
It's an interesting observation, Heather. Let's see what
that's a great observation. And, you know, since its birth, really, on the plains of South Africa in the 1880s, the modern diamond industry has always tried to anticipate social trends and to try and find a way to sneak the diamond in there. And I think what the caller is referring to is the right-hand ring, which women are being encouraged to buy.
That's what they call it?
Yeah. This is an explicit campaign aimed at women who have delayed marriage or have perhaps chosen not to get married, that they, too, can participate in you know, this somewhat bogus custom by gifting themselves with a diamond and putting it on their right hand.
Very observant. Heather, thanks for the call to Radio Times.
No, thank you.
You're welcome. Let me get Zaid from North Philadelphia to join us. Zaid, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I simply have a statement, which is, what is done about the land once the land is mined and the damage is done to the land? Is the companies that's doing all this mining, do they reconstruct the land or send someone in to repair it in some sort of way?
Well, Zaid, it's an interesting question, and let's, I guess, roll back our conversation a bit and describe, if you could, Tom, what these diamond mines look like.
Well, there's two kinds of mines, and that's a great question, Zaid. I appreciate it. There's the alluvial mines, which are the diamonds which have washed into riverbeds, and basically what you're doing is you're digging up river sands. And so on the spectrum of environmental damage, I mean, it doesn't look great, but, you know, it's not quite like gold mining where you're pouring cyanide on your ore. So, you know, there's that, and then there's actually digging into the ancient volcanic pipe, mining into the kimberlite. And this is a bit more environmentally destructive. It releases some heavy metals, and it looks like a big open copper pit. And so the mines up in the Canadian Arctic, actually, the government is requiring them to, you know, basically rehabilitate that land when it's over. Such controls do not exist in other nations, however.
Oh, that's interesting. Could you talk a little bit more about what is happening in the Northwest Territories of Canada? Where, I guess, what are they actually drilling into the ice looking for diamonds?
Yeah, the hunt for diamonds pushes further and further north towards the North Pole every year. And,
really?
Global warming and the melting of the polar ice has even opened up this commerce. And so, the diamond lust is taking geologists and diamond miners to places which had previously been utterly untouched.
And we're talking about diamonds that come from the center of the earth, the molten core of the earth, or pieces of carbon, I guess.
Yeah, pieces of compressed carbon. And the way they came up to the surface is through the tubes of ancient magma known as kimberlite.
And they just, over time and through pressure, they work their way up to the surface of the earth?
Actually, it was very quick. The diamond was crushed and heated in the mantle But it came up to the surface of the Earth through very violent, quick means, about 100 miles an hour through this tube of magma. Yeah.
Wow. Well, Zahid, thanks for the question to Radio Times. You can call in as well with any questions or comments. We're talking about diamonds with Tom Zollner, author of The Heartless Stone, 1-888-477-9499. We've got Nikunj from Newark, Delaware, joining us. Nikunj, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. And first of all, I'd like to thank your guest for giving such a wonderful insight into the diamond industry and its workings.
Great.
And I'm basically from India, and this is regarding the comments that your guest made about, you know, child labor in diamond industry in India.
In India.
Right. And I have some friends who used to work in diamond industry when I was in India, and my impression was that, you know, it's not intensive physical labor. It's basically, you know, like any, I've seen kids doing jobs here also. So I wanted to basically ask your guest, how were the working conditions over there? Did you see any kind of, you know, intensive physical labor being, you know, asked them to do, or were they... basically, you know, are the working conditions really bad over there?
Sure, the working conditions.
Yeah,
in
no.
India. Thanks for the question.
Yeah, great question. I appreciate it. Yeah, these guys are basically sitting around a spinning wheel for 10 to 12 hours a day. And, you know, on the spectrum of hard labor, it's, you know, not exactly like, you know, lifting bales of hay.
Right.
But nonetheless, what is happening, which is really insidious, is that many of these workshops are unventilated. And the dust thrown up from the wheel, not the dust from the diamond, that's actually surprisingly harmless. It's actually the dust from the metal shavings on the wheel that get kicked up. That is known to cause asthma and heart arrhythmia and so forth. And so employers are supposed to ventilate their workshops properly, but in all the factories that I was in, I didn't see it. And so these guys are, and the children too, are at risk of lung ailments.
Nikunj, thanks for calling into Radio Times. How did the Hasidim get involved in the diamond industry? What's the story there?
Yeah, this goes back centuries, and it's because of the great prejudice that they suffered in Europe. You know, they could not join trade guilds, they could not engage in other methods of making a living, and so, you know, diamonds became kind of their province. They were seen as methods of portable wealth when fleeing persecution. This was a way that you could, you know, essentially move, you know, your family savings away from those who were trying to persecute you. And so the diamond has taken on an almost mystical role in the culture.
Interesting. Let me get Mitch from Bryn Mawr to join us this morning on Radio Times. Hi, Mitch. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I'd like to ask your guest if he has any comment on an advertising campaign that was run by De Beers a number of years ago with the tagline, give her diamonds and watch the sparks fly. I thought that was one of the most offensive advertising campaigns I'd ever seen. There was a particular ad I remember in which a man pours a diamond necklace that looked like it was worth about $5 million into a woman's hand, and then she grabs him and kisses him passionately, and then you get the tagline. And the whole implication of the advertising campaign was that if you get, that women are willing to trade diamonds for sex.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's amazing. I went through a lot of these ads, and there's a long section in the book about the very blatant, in many cases, sexual subtext going on in these diamond advertisements, and you know the assumption that, you know, this is what women are after, and we all know what men are after, and so, you know,
a little transaction.
Yeah, there
here,
you
right?
go.
Mitch, thanks for calling into Radio Times.
Well, I was just a little surprised that we didn't see a public outcry from feminist groups that. De Beers was calling the average woman a prostitute.
Well, I don't actually remember that particular ad. I mean, I certainly remember Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. Maybe that really dates me because that probably dates Watch the Sparks Fly.
Yeah, and you know, the majority of diamond advertisements, whether it's played pianissimo or whether it's played fortissimo, you know, you see this sexual subtext going on, absolutely, and that's very perceptive on the colors part.
Mitch, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me get Elizabeth from Laurel Springs to join us. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
I had read years ago that the diamond trade was used to fund rebels in Sierra Leone, which has always been my objection to owning one, And I'm wondering if your guest can speak to that.
Sure can.
Certainly. Actually, Sierra Leone was the worst of the diamond-fueled wars in Africa of the late 1990s. And it was partly the horrors in Sierra Leone. And that war was not at all about political ideology. That war was about wealth, actually. It was about seizing diamond mines and, you know, making the generals rich. And so, you know, just horrific things happened there. People getting their arms chopped off as a method of intimidation. And so that war has damped down, as have the other two civil wars of the late 1990s. But, you know, what is unfortunate is that Africa is either cursed or blessed, depending on your perspective, with a galaxy of these diamonds. And they're only out there waiting to be mined, waiting to be picked up. And we just don't know where the next conflict is going to erupt.
And whether it will ever be used for good or whether it will always be the subsidy of conflict and violence.
Yeah. You know, it must be said that there are nations in Africa, Namibia, Botswana, to some degree South Africa, which have used diamonds for development purposes, which have taken this, you know, rather silly form of wealth, really, this totally arbitrary construct, and used it for good. But for the most part, diamonds have been actually brought misery and warfare to the places where they've been scattered.
But it's so interesting to compress this history into an hour's conversation, to think about diamonds still having the kind of mythology that it had early on, especially in this advertising campaign that got started here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, right here in Philadelphia. And De Beers understood better than anyone the what's in our human hearts, which is this constant need to make meaning out of the things that surround us. And you know, they very cleverly put the diamond, you know, to some degree at the center of that, of our constant need for inanimate objects, for icons.
And do you think, final question here, but do you think that diamonds will end up being like fur coats, you know, that people who wear them sometimes defiantly are saying something, and the people who criticize them are, that it becomes a political issue?
Yeah, and that was part of the reason why the Kimberley process, this very lax but, you know, still a step in the right direction, why this was created, is they did not want to become another fur. They wanted to head off those protests.
Yeah. And do you think it's possible, based on your research and observations, to have a kind of a system that could tell people if a particular diamond is a conflict or blood diamond or not?
So far, that's eluded us.
But is it possible, do you think, to create a system where you could know where a particular diamond came from?
A foolproof system is going to be very difficult just because of the intrinsic qualities of a diamond.
Well, Tom Zollner, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And his book is called The Heartless Stone, and it's subtitled A Journey Through the World of Diamonds, Deceit, and Desire, and it's published by St. Martin's Press. He has worked as a reporter for Men's Health magazine and for the San Francisco Chronicle. Devorah Lissick, Alan Tu, Susan Greenbaum produce Radio Times. Scotty Williams, the engineer for today's edition of the program. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Leave us an email and find out more about the program as well. I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, and worldwide at whyy.org.